This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, is North Korea honoring its commitment to Washington to move toward denuclearization? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. After meeting with North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un in Singapore this past June, U.S. President Donald Trump was effusive. Meeting with Kim Jong-un, he said, was an interesting and very positive experience. The president also fantasized about the country's real estate potential, especially the communist state's pristine beaches. Yet, after 6 months of canceled meetings and statements of dissatisfaction by both countries, progress seems stalled between Washington and Pyongyang. Many experts trace the source of this problem to the Singapore Declaration signed at the historic summit. In just over 400 words, it says that the United States will normalize relations with North Korea in exchange for denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. But the declaration doesn't specify a process, sequence, or timeline within which the goals would occur. Moreover, there is not even an agreed definition of the term denuclearization. America believes North Korea must first give up its nuclear program or take irreversible steps toward this goal before sanctions are lifted. North Korea, on the other hand, claims it has already made several important concessions that demonstrate goodwill, such as a freeze on nuclear testing and the dismantling of the Punggye-ri nuclear site. Pyongyang says it is now America's turn to match these gestures. Meanwhile, President Moon Jae-in of South Korea has continued to push for greater engagement with the North. Since the April 27th summit between the two Koreas, Mr. Moon has opened the first inter-Korean liaison office, demolished 11 military guard posts within the demilitarized zone, and, just last week, his plan to conduct a joint field study on connecting the South's and North's railways was approved by the UN Security Council. As South Korea improves relations with the North, analysts say frustration is building that its efforts have not been matched with a corresponding improvement in ties between Pyongyang and Washington. With us to follow up on the status of the Singapore Declaration are two distinguished analysts. Gene Lee is director of the Hyundai Motor Korea Foundation Center for Korean History and Public Policy at the Woodrow Wilson Center, and that's a think tank based in Washington, and Bruce Klingner. He's senior research fellow for Northeast Asia at the Heritage Foundation, and that's a think tank also based here in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us.
Hi.
So, Bruce Klingner, why 6 months after this mini-summit in Singapore, after Mr. Trump confidently said that he and Mr. Kim had, quote, solved the problem and there was no longer a nuclear threat, are we at this impasse? What went wrong?
Well, we can point to, as you did, the shortfalls of the Singapore summit. It's sort of once again the flaws of an agreement with North Korea, consistent with all the other previous failed agreements, where it's very vague, it's very short, it doesn't clearly delineate what each side is supposed to do. And many of us think that President Trump rushed into this summit and committed a number of errors. But I think if you take a step back, what's consistent through this diplomatic effort with all the other attempts is that North Korea is not willing to really move forward on doing what it's required to do under 11 UN Security Council resolutions, which is abandon its nuclear, missile, and biological and chemical warfare programs in, as the UN requires, a complete, verifiable, irreversible manner.
Gene Lee, what's your take?
I don't think it's over yet. And so I am somebody who, like Bruce, was critical of the way that the summit came about in Singapore. But here we are at this point where he met with Kim Jong-un, gave him that legitimacy by sitting down with him in Singapore. But I don't think that this is over yet. We are at the start of this process, and it's not surprising at all that it's happening in fits and starts. Anyone who thought it was going to be wrapped up nicely by year's end is delusional, frankly, because North Korea has played this game for a very long time, and they know how to play this game. I think they're somewhat confused right now, perhaps about what President Trump's priorities are and what the next steps are. And so what we need to see is for the two sides to work out that roadmap to what the next steps are so they can push this process forward.
Bruce Klingner, what about this concept of denuclearization? I have a sense that the two sides still do not have the same definition of the word. What is your understanding of Washington's interpretation, and what is North Korea's interpretation, and can they ever be reconciled?
We do need to reconcile them. You can't continue to paper over differences as we've often done in previous agreements. And if you look at the arms control treaties we had with the Soviet Union, they were very lengthy, very detailed, very carefully crafted, including definitions of things that seem straightforward, like what is a missile, what is a tank, what is an artillery piece. But the U.S. sees denuclearization as what's required under the U.N. resolutions. North Korea abandoned its nuclear arsenal along with missiles and BCW, and it has to be done in a verified manner. And so it's a pretty clear cut. You have to do what is required. The North Koreans in discussions with myself and with others in and out of government, you know, they define denuclearization as global arms control. And as a new self-professed member of the nuclear club, they'll go to zero when the rest of the members of the nuclear club, including the United States, go down to zero. So that would be our ICBMs, our submarines, everything. There's differences over what is the Korean Peninsula. The U.S. sees it as the landmass, half of which is already denuclearized. South Korea has no nuclear weapons. North Korea defines it as anything that impacts or influences the peninsula. So that includes our strategic bombers way down in Guam. It includes our dual-capable aircraft in Japan. It includes our aircraft carriers and our submarines. One might even argue it could include our ICBMs in North Dakota. So we don't even agree on very basic precepts.
If we can't agree on very basic precepts, Gene Lee, how can we really move forward? What is your take on the discrepancy between the U.S. interpretation of what denuclearization means and that of Pyongyang?
What was laid out was an end goal, the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. And absolutely, I think we have a problem here, because if one side is talking about just denuclearization of the northern half of the peninsula and the other side is saying, no, hey, wait a minute, we're talking about removing the entire nuclear umbrella over South Korea as well, then there's a problem. However, if we're looking at that as an end goal, then what we have to focus on are the steps in between that both sides are working toward. And I really think that that's what we need to focus on. I think that anyone who knows North Korea knows that it's going to be very unlikely and very hard for them to completely give up their nuclear weapons. It is one of the only things that they have. It's the only leverage that they have. It just seems unlikely that they would completely give them up first. However, they can take some concrete, verifiable steps toward that end goal and perhaps earn some sanctions relief in return. It's not surprising to me at all that both leaders, President Trump included, and the Trump administration would be in public talking about the end goal, but hopefully in between, they're working on that timeline and the steps needed to get to that point.
So Bruce Klingier, do you think, given what Gene Lee says, that the U.S. administration's all-or-nothing approach, or what is known as maximum pressure on Pyongyang to dismantle its nuclear weapons infrastructure, is possibly unrealistic?
You know, there are a number of ways we can kind of unpack some of the baggage here. Is we define what the endpoint is, and you know, negotiations, well, with North Korea, with the Soviet Union, with others, is always difficult. But again, as we did with the arms control treaty, is you work through what can be a grueling, lengthy process, but you need to define, as Gene pointed out, you know, sort of the end point, the end goal, as well as the intermediate goals. But you need to define what is going to be covered, what the requirements by all sides are, what they have to do. And then you can argue or negotiate about the linkages of how many from column A to get how many in column B and timelines. But I think you need to have it in a comprehensive document. So you need to get the negotiators in the room. The problem is right now North Korea is refusing to meet with Special Envoy Steve Biegun. Even the senior level meetings with Secretary Pompeo have been postponed due to a lack of progress. And what I think North Korea is trying to do is basically decouple the president from the rest of the administration. They see President Trump as more likely to give concessions, so they want to just go right to the top and have another Singapore-like summit where the president gave away a number of things and really got nothing in return, in my view. And I thought Trump had three major mistakes in Singapore. The first is, again, agreeing to a flawed document. The second would be unilaterally canceling U.S. military exercises or allied military exercises without even consulting the Secretary of Defense, the Pentagon, or our allies. And that, for North Korea, has been the gift that keeps on giving, because people assumed it just meant Freedom Guardian, a major exercise. But since then, we've had 6, 7, 8 or so military exercises canceled. And we've set the precedent now where if we were to say, look, you know, it's been a while, our capabilities are degrading, we need to start training again, North Korea will blame us for torpedoing the negotiations. And then the third mistake was what I would call the beautification of Kim Jong-un. Here's someone that the United Nations has deemed as a purveyor of crimes against humanity. And President Trump not only claimed he had totally solved the nuclear problem, but he describes Kim Jong-un as a smart cookie, we're in love with each other, he loves his people. You know, even Neville Chamberlain didn't describe Adolf Hitler as a nice guy who loved his people. You know, this kind of beautification of Kim Jong-un, it undermines the international resolve to maintain pressure on North Korea until they comply with the resolutions.
Well, Gene Lee, there's a lot to unpack there. But if you could address Bruce's point about how North Korea is looking at Trump, decoupling him from the rest of the administration, trying to gain advantage and wanting to deal with the top and not, you know, the nitty-gritty of taking these steps.
That's absolutely right. The North Koreans tend to play a game of divide and conquer. And this is, in one form, a game of divide and conquer between Trump and his administration. You know, I spent so much time negotiating with North Koreans myself in my small little world, which was opening a news bureau. But it was the same kind of thing. They did that with media outlets trying to play us off one another. And that's what we're seeing, in a sense, in the way that they are trying to humiliate Steve Biegun and Secretary of State Pompeo, in a sense, by not meeting with them and trying to put pressure on this whole process by saying, hey, we're not going to meet with you unless you can go to the very top. We shouldn't look at it with too much alarm. I think it's a very typical game that the North Koreans play. And so the smart approach would be to be somewhat patient and not succumb to that kind of pressure. And yet the U.S. administration does have to find a way to move that process forward. This is partly what we saw under the Obama administration when they played this game of strategic patience, was not trying to get too ruffled or too unnerved by the games that the North Koreans play. And yet you can't completely ignore these moves that the North Koreans are playing. You have to find a way to get ahead of that manipulation.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Gene Lee. She's director of the Hyundai Motor Korea Foundation Center for Korean History and Public Policy at the Wilson Center, a think tank based here in Washington, and Bruce Klingner. He's senior research fellow for Northeast Asia at the Heritage Foundation, and that's a think tank also here in Washington. And we're discussing events following the Singapore summit between Washington and Pyongyang. What progress, if any, has been made toward denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula? And this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal listener and Facebook fan, Nawan Emmanuel Jr. from Wa, Ghana. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Bruce Klingner. Let's just move for a moment to this other interrelated track, and that is the rapprochement we're seeing between South and North Korea, pushed particularly by President Moon Jae-in. He's very eager to improve these ties with the North and for the United States and North Korea to make more progress on the nuclear front. But we know that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that the allies, Seoul and Washington, need to make sure that they coordinate their actions. Do you see friction between Washington and Seoul on strategy toward North Korea?
Very much so. And until recently, it was able to be kept private. And when I talk to U.S. officials, they would say that publicly they're smiles and we're shoulder to shoulder and on the same sheet of music, etc. But that privately, very stern messages were being sent to Seoul to knock it off. You're going too far too fast, that you can't have the good cop get too far ahead of the bad cop. Not that I think this is really a coordinated policy. And that the strains were becoming so great that they may not be able to keep it private much longer. And in the last month or so, we've seen it come out into the public. But when I talk to officials in Seoul, they'd say, we don't know who you're talking to. Everything is fine. There's no differences at all. And then it came really out in the public. And Secretary Pompeo has made a number of comments. And anonymous U.S. officials are now being willing to be quoted. So it really is a divergence of views and strategy. President Moon, I think, is driven really by two things. One is sort of this innate policy called the Sunshine Policy, where it's you sort of front load a lot of benefits to the North in order to make them feel less threatened. You ease the turtle's head out of the shell, et cetera. So you have to make a lot of concessions early on. Also, I think President Moon was very concerned by what looked like a U.S. move towards a military attack at the beginning of this year. And things were happening. Many Korea watchers in Washington were getting quite concerned. We saw military movements and other things that suggested that we were getting close. So I think President Moon is really driven to focus on improving relations with the North. The U.S. has the view of trying to eliminate the threat as well as enforce UN resolutions. So it's different objectives. We hope that we can reconcile them. The U.S. view is that South Korea should just stop promising an ever-growing list of economic benefits to the North, all of which would be violations of UN resolutions or U.S. law if they were actually implemented.
So, Gene Lee, how do you see the differences between the United States and South Korea vis-a-vis strategy toward North Korea? How is it affecting the relationship between Washington and Seoul and any attempts the United States is trying to make to force North Korea to make concessions on the nuclear front?
It's very clear that President Moon Jae-in of South Korea and his administration are trying to capitalize on the momentum that this rapprochement offers, and that they are trying to drive the process forward so quickly so that we can't go back. You can't blame the South Koreans. They've been living with the threat of provocation from North Korea for years, and they would, generally speaking, prefer to have some peace over that provocation. However, the concern is that they're pushing that process forward so quickly without getting much in return from the North Koreans on denuclearization, and then that gap between Washington and Seoul is just widening. One of the concerns I have had is that in order to carry out some of these projects that they've promised the North Koreans, they have had to ask for exceptions to UN sanctions. And this has been the case, certainly when they brought the North Koreans for the Olympics, which took place in South Korea earlier this year. That was the case in order to allow them to travel to South Korea. Once you start granting exemptions, you start to weaken the effectiveness of those sanctions. And so that is a concern. And that's precisely what the North Koreans want. I wanted to mention one thing, too. We should recognize that this is a different group of South Koreans in the Blue House, in the presidential Blue House in Seoul, than we've seen over the past 10 years. Previously, we had a conservative administration. This is now a different group of South Koreans who feel strongly that North and South Koreans should be driving what happens on the Korean Peninsula. And that is quite a different attitude than past South Korean presidents. So it's something that we should be aware of and just keep in mind. But it does mean that there's this underlying feeling among that group of South Koreans that they should be the ones determining the future of what happens in their country.
Well, to that point, Bruce Klenier, looking at the politics in South Korea, as Gene Lee said, Moon's administration sees diplomatic engagement with the North as very positive, but conservatives accuse Moon of playing into Kim's hand and risking the U.S.-South Korean alliance, which is South Korea's ultimate protection from a very menacing North Korea. So how do you see the split in the country? Is most of the population with President Moon, or is there a partisan ideological split in South Korea vis-a-vis its approach to North Korea?
You know, I think the difference in the U.S. and South Korean strategy is sort of like the difference between how a policeman and a social worker would want to deal with a criminal. The policeman would say, he's broken the law. There are clear repercussions when someone breaks the law. Why not apply the law? If you don't apply the law, or if you turn a blind eye, or if you allow exceptions, you're not only undermining your effectiveness in this case, but also you're undermining kind of the rule of law. The South Koreans see it more as a social worker. Well, there were reasons why he did this, a crime, society's to blame. We should give benefits in order to induce this person to move away from a life of crime. In South Korea, there are divisions between progressives and conservatives. You know, right now, President Moon is very popular. His popularity is declining a bit, but still to a level that other presidents would envy. I think over time, what we've seen is a little more cynicism about how much progress has been made this year. You know, and over the years, the South Korean engagement with the North, say, under the previous progressive presidents, had very, very high levels of support. And then over time, it went down. And so by the time Kim Dae-jung, the creator of the Sunshine Policy, left office, support for his Sunshine Policy was down to 14%. now it's gone back up. So there does tend to be sort of a cyclical support for engagement with North Korea, either based on North Korean behavior or even U.S. behavior if we're seen as the part of the problem. So it's not a constant. But there are differences of view within South Korea, just as in the United States.
Anything to add or subtract to that, Jean Lee, with regard to the internal divisions?
I would say that, you know, I was in South Korea as a reporter in 2000 when Kim Dae-jung had the first inter-Korean summit with the late leader Kim Jong-il. And the mood on the ground was very hopeful. It was the first time these leaders were meeting, and there was so much hope that we were on a different path with North Korea. 18 years later, I think the mood is very different. There's a lot more skepticism, hope that we're on a different path, but also the realization that in 18 years, that process only led us to a point where North Korea has built nuclear weapons. And so I actually think that's very healthy. I don't think anyone should be going into this with any illusions. It's just have to be smart about it. But the broader context here is that if you have family and living in South Korea like I do, you do ultimately want some sort of peace and some sort of agreement with the North Koreans that they coexist peacefully. So you do have to think about that larger picture, and I think that's what the South Koreans are doing. But I always want to urge them to be smart about it. And skepticism with the North Koreans is okay.
Well, back to you, Bruce Klingner, because there's another big topic before we end the program, and that's this desire to formally end the Korean War. There's an armistice, but the thought is that this war needs to be ended formally. How does that either facilitate or potentially complicate talk over denuclearization of North Korea? And how about the sequencing? Does Kim Jong-un want this to happen before any inventory and any kind of giving up of his nuclear arsenal? Because this is a very important issue.
North Korea says it's done so much and the U.S. hasn't done anything. And so one of the things they're looking for the U.S. to do is to sign an end-of-war declaration or a peace declaration, not even necessarily a peace treaty yet, which is a bit more of a formal document. And now South Korea, you know, is advocating on behalf of North Korea's desire for this end-of-war declaration. And in many ways, South Korea is acting like North Korea's lawyer. It's advocating against the U.S. pressure policy. And indeed, South Korean officials sort of downplay its significance. Sort of when they advocate on its behalf, they'll say, look, the document is very short. It's pretty meaningless. It's political. It's symbolic. It really has no effect at all. So why not sign it? The North Koreans will like it. They'll act better. And then I go back to them and say, okay, what specific objective are you trying to achieve? What quid pro quo will you actually get from North Korea in response to this? If it's to make North Korea feel less threatened, oh, by the way, which Korea has attacked and killed the other more often since 1953? It's always the North. If North Korea feels warmer and fuzzier, how will they act differently? And how is this piece of paper going to have any bigger impact than the 20 or more documents we've signed saying we promise not to attack North Korea with conventional or nuclear weapons? The South Korean government advocates for a peace declaration can't answer any of those questions. So it seems like if you can't identify your objectives or what you'll get in return, why do it? And I see there are two dangers to doing it. One would be it would further undermine international resolve on maintaining pressure and enforcing laws. And then it also leads to potentially a slippery slope of if you sign a peace declaration, how can you not sign a peace treaty which would disband the United Nations command? And why do you have so many troops here? And why do you have a nuclear umbrella guarantee? And why do we have an alliance, et cetera, et cetera? So I see a number of potential negatives, and I don't really see any positive upside to this declaration.
Well, you get the last word, Jean Lee, because there's so much more to talk about. But what about this particular end of war declaration, notwithstanding the fact that it's not the formal ending of the war? But could that help or hurt as we go forward?
I do think it is a big gamble, and that once you go down that path, that the North Koreans could potentially use it in that relationship, and it'll be troublesome. And I do agree that a peace treaty would take many, many years to sort out, so it would be the start of a process. However, I can tell you that in Pyongyang, and I spent so much time there, the ideology of this Korean War battle that they say that the North Koreans are currently engaged in, it's so much a part of their identity. And so one of the things that Kim Jong-un needs is to be able to tell his people that they've moved past that. And so in a sense, what that declaration would do is give him something to take back to his people, another victory, and to be able to tell them, we're done with this now. We can now fully focus on the economy.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm afraid that's all the time we have, although it's been a fascinating conversation, which will have to be continued. I'd like to thank my guest, Jean Lee. She's director of the Hyundai Motor Korea Foundation Center for Korean History and Public Policy at the Woodrow Wilson Center here in Washington, and Bruce Klingner, senior research fellow for Northeast Asia at the Heritage Foundation. Thanks so much for a terrific conversation.
It was a good conversation. Thank you.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Encounter was produced here in Washington. Thanks to Cindy Lim for producing this program. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.